Welcome back to Community in Code. I'm your host, Chris Reynolds, and I will be honest with you all, I blew it on this episode. In my intake form, I have a name pronunciation field, and before we hit record, I double check with my guests, especially when there might be different ways of pronouncing a name. My guest today is Natalie McLeese. McLeese. And we had a conversation before hitting record about how some people get it wrong and say McLeese. I promised myself and Natalie that I would get it right and immediately said the wrong thing. And that's kind of a decent setup for this episode, because one of the things that Natalie and I talk about is about how accessibility isn't just about permanent disabilities, it's about situational ones too, like being distracted and in your own head enough that you say the wrong name even when you said it right the first time. Your brain knows the right answer, but something gets in the way of actually executing it. Good accessibility design accounts for cognitive as well as physical disabilities, because really, it's about inviting everyone into your website. Natalie has been involved in the WordPress world since she stumbled into it, looking for something interesting to do one weekend in San Francisco, and now she's a longtime WordCamp organizer and the founder of Aardvark, three A's, an accessibility testing platform that she created because she needed something for her own work. I'll let Natalie tell her own story. Let's get into it. Welcome to Community in Code, the podcast where we talk to the human beings behind the commits. And I'm here today with Natalie McLeese. I said it wrong. I said I was going to say it wrong. I said it wrong. McLeese. How could I even do that? Like, it's the thing where you're in your own head. That's totally what it was. McLeese. Natalie McLeese is an accessibility expert in the WordPress ecosystem. Welcome to the show, Natalie. I'm very sorry to do the thing I exactly explicitly said I was not going to do. Tell us about yourself.
Hi, thanks for having me. No worries. It happens all the time. So I'm Natalie McLeese.
The secret is like, no, that was actually all planned entirely. It just like right? makes a better cold open.
I'm currently founder of Aardvark with three A's. We're an accessibility testing platform. And previous to that, I am co-founder and half owner of N Squared. We're a small company that builds WordPress plugins. I have a partner, Nathan Tyler. Before that, I was building WordPress websites, and yeah, that's where we came from and where we are now.
I think is the connecting tissue. I think because I know Nathan. Nathan used to work with me back in the olden days. Yes.
Yes, he did.
Yes. Well, great. Awesome. Now I'm centered in time and space and reality. Tell me about the thing that brought you into WordPress, into web development in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So those are two different stories.
Okay, great. start with the first one.
Okay.
Well, I mean, whatever happened chronologically first, I would say.
Okay, chronologically first, it was 1996 and I got my first computer.
There you go.
And somehow came across something one day that said, build your own website. And I was like, wait, you can make this yourself? All of my time, hours and hours and hours. Then went into hand coding HTML websites before CSS existed. Mm-hmm. Making them do all kinds of stuff. I actually had like a reasonably popular website at the time that had puzzles on it, like logic puzzles for people to solve. And I would update them once a month. So you could come back next month and get the answers if you can even imagine. And if I was late.
And that also is like before RSS and like any sort of like notification.
Oh, yeah.
So like people would actually need to physically type the URL into the address bar and intentionally go to that website again month after month. Yeah.
Yes. And I would get emails if I was late updating the answers to the puzzles. And then, you know, I guess it was almost 10 years later that I had started a little business doing freelance web development, and somebody approached me and she wanted a blog. She was a photographer and a poet, and she wanted a little blog where she could post her artsy photo and her little poem every day. And I looked around and decided that WordPress was the right solution and built my first WordPress website in 2007. And then that same year, just by a weird coincidence, I happened to be in San Francisco and I was looking for something to do, and there was a WordCamp. And it was, it turns out it was the second ever WordCamp that happened.
Wait, what year is that?
2007.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a WordCamp San Francisco in 2006. And then I went in 2007, and there was a couple other WordCamps that year, but they were after San Francisco. So it was the second one ever that Matt organized himself and was there running it. Yeah. So I just kind of, that's when I realized that I hadn't just made a decision to use a piece of software. I'd bought into a community of people. And I met some really amazing people. I honestly, it was completely unexpected, because I just kind of stumbled into that because I was looking for something to do. And I happened to be up there the same weekend that that happened. And it was so welcoming and so warm and so wonderful to talk to people who could relate to the issues that I was having and, you know, dealing with clients and all of that. And yeah, I was really involved with the WordPress community quite a bit after that.
I had a similar experience at my first WordCamp, which was WordCamp Utah, and I think in 2010. I volunteered because I didn't, at the time I was freelancing and probably working part-time at Whole Foods. So like, yeah, like $20 I think was still like, do I really want to spend the money? Oh, I can get a free ticket if I volunteer. Okay, I'm going to do that. So, I worked the Happiness Bar, which is, actually before we called them Happiness Bars, when we were calling them Genius Bars before, we decided that that was a bad idea. and I met through that, two guys who are local who had started an event management plugin, Event Espresso. One of them, Seth, was also doing the Happiness Bar with me. And so we got to talking, and I ended up getting a job out of the gig, which was my first actual WordPress job. I mean, outside of, you know, freelancing for myself. So like, yeah, it was the same sort of thing where like, I didn't really know this was a thing. Like, I knew that there were people out there. I was in like the IRC channels. The thing that kept me around in WordPress was the fact that I knew that if I Google searched for a thing, for a, an answer or a question, I could find resources online, which wasn't true with other things I had been using otherwise before that. So that was always the thing that, kept me. But like then being able to meet people in person and have real conversations. And then obviously like the next year I was a speaker. And then the year after that, I was like a volunteer organizer and just got more and more involved. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a really great community to be part of. And I probably couldn't even like name all the ways that that community, being a part of that, changed my, the, you know, trajectory of my career and even my life. Like so many of my friends are people that I met through that community. My business partner I met through that community.
Yeah,
so
yeah. What was, I'm interested in the period between like the 1996 first hand-coded website and the 10 years later when you're finding WordPress. Like what was the in-betweeny part? Was it just like making sites for yourself for fun or doing stuff for your friends? And like how, yeah, what was the sort of stuff that you were like, where is that sort of surfacing? Because I have my own answer, and like I'm interested in how much of like the parallels there are.
Yeah, so it was mostly just messing around and making little hobby sites. Like I had a job. I was in college in the 90s, and I had a job working at a shoe store, and I made like a little website for the shoe store that I worked at, but nothing super serious. And then in 2000, I got a job building websites for the chemistry department at a university. So the little websites that would have, you know, the notes and the study guides for the tests and then the answers for the test afterward and all of that, that was my job, was building all of those out. And that was a lot of Microsoft Front Page. And then I transitioned to Dreamweaver. And I was still pretty heavily building Dreamweaver sites for random freelance customers when this poet photographer came to me wanting a blog. Yeah.
Yeah, I at some point was using Note Plus, Notepad plus plus.
Yep.
I think my so I was also my first computer was also 96, I believe. It was a Windows 95 computer. That's how I remember it was 96 because it wasn't the year it came out. I also like my very first computer. I like to remember that like it had Microsoft Bob. I don't know how many human beings on the planet still remember Microsoft Bob. It was, it's a wild thing. Like if you think about early days of like Windows computers, so Mac had existed and people were starting to gravitate toward Mac computers because they're easier to use. And so Windows, obviously, Microsoft had to come up with something that was even easier and better. So Bob was like a layer on top of your computer where it's like it turned your interface into like a house that you could like customize. So you could like customize the different rooms and then put application shortcuts into the different rooms. And then obviously like change the paint and whatever. And like there's a dog involved somehow. And like yeah, you just go into the different rooms and find it. And it was, I mean, as obtrusive as Clippy is, Bob is like Clippy, except like if Clippy was the entire operating system. But I got on GeoCities and I was like using Notepad to like copy and paste bits of HTML until I figured out how to do it myself. But like yeah, my first real like and I was making websites for myself and for friends. I made like a models site. Like I had some friends that were photographers, and I had some friends that were models. And so I made a site where you could like I linked out to the photographers, and I linked out to the models, and so you could kind of like make your connections or whatever. But then I got a on-campus job at my university for I think the HR department, and that was the most boring web. I was a webmaster
Oh,
back
yeah.
when. Yeah. And that was the most boring job I could possibly imagine, actually.
Yeah, that doesn't sound super exciting. I don't know, chemistry websites, like maybe just a tiny bit above it. It's on excitement level.
But then, okay, so you're getting involved in the WordPress community. Are you speaking? Are you organizing? Are you volunteering?
All of the above. Yep. I've got a lot of badges on my WordPress.org profile. So I organized WordCamp LA in 2013, 2014, and I was on the organizing team in 2015. I've spoken at, I don't know, maybe 50 different WordCamps. I used to run the WordPress meetup group in Los Angeles. And I've got plugins. I built a ton of sites. So yeah, I've got a lot of experience in WordPress and then in the WordPress community as well.
So one of the things that like obviously I'm sure you've noticed and I've noticed it as well is like especially since COVID like there's just so much less momentum and just sort of like impetus I feel like in particularly North America or maybe just US based WordCamps. Like I feel like other parts of the world have kind of figured it out and picked it back up but we haven't.
No, we really haven't. Yeah.
What's up with that?
I don't know. Yeah, I've been noticing that there's like a pretty good number of WordCamps and WordCamp meetups happening in other countries, and in the US it's barely anything. And I think I've only been to one or two WordCamps since the pandemic. I was at WordCamp US in December. I think it was December, right, of 2029, or I'm sorry, 2019, like right before the pandemic.
That was what, Nashville?
St. Louis.
Oh, this is St. Louis. That's right. St. Louis came after Nashville.
And then since then, I went to WordCamp US when it was in San Diego, and I think that might be it.
I went to Nashville, I went to St. Louis, and then yeah, then there was a pause. And yeah, it's just been a really like I haven't seen them pop back up. They just haven't popped back up. That's why I'm really excited about like there's interest in other sort of non-camp events. Like I'm looking forward to PressConf. I mean, when this comes out, maybe it's will be super close. I don't know. But or maybe it will have already have happened. But like having like other things that are happening because I feel like I don't know. It's so valuable to meet with and hang out with other people who do similar things, especially when you're freelancing or you're working remotely. To even just vibe check, even just like share notes. It's especially isolating when you're freelancing and you just don't have a community around you. And I imagine like, within WordPress, like obviously there's a WordPress core Slack, but there's like we have like post status and WP Campus and other things. But it's really easy to just like not be part of those things.
I remember when I was still going to meetups on a regular basis. I feel like at every one, the host would say, "How many people have been to a WordCamp?" And almost no one had even heard of this event or knew that it happened. And I mean, the percentage of people who have WordPress sites who go to meetups or WordCamps or anything is tiny. Most people just they don't even realize that there's a community to be involved in, even though it's right there on their dashboard every time they log in.
And even though now like you can enter in your location or your zip code or whatever and it'll geolocate to find things that are closer to you. It's so hard and like I it's and I'm obviously now there's like particular US-based complications with hosting events and traveling for events and like traveling here for events or traveling, out of state even for events necessary. But like so there's nuances and there's layers, but yeah, it's definitely like it's definitely sad to see that there hasn't been as much impetus. Like I organized too and I was co-organizer for 2 years. I was lead organizer for WordCamp Salt Lake for 2 years, and I was done. My last year, I was done. I'm like, I'm good.
It's a lot of work.
yeah, it's a lot of work, but it really takes somebody to put like a whole lot of time and effort and identity into running something like that. And if you don't have like a good sort of succession plan, then I think that that's And I think I maybe that maybe that's even the issue, right? Like COVID hit us and was unexpected, and then we broke, and then when we came back, people are at various stages of burnout, and there isn't a succession plan, right? Like there wasn't like we didn't expect that to happen.
It kind of broke the chain.
On that sad note, tell me about accessibility. What got you into accessibility specifically?
So it was that job at the university. So I was super excited to have my first gig where I was actually getting paid to do something I loved, which like blew my mind that somebody would pay me to do something that I loved so much. And I was a few months into the job, and the Office of Disability Services called me and said, "Hey, it's nice you're building these websites, but there's some students who can't use them." And I had no idea what they were talking about. No idea. Like, had never heard of accessibility, had no concept of assistive technology or any of it. And they were very nice,
Good.
kind of explained it all to me. And then, it's a university, so free training for lots of stuff. And I took advantage of everything they had to offer and figured it all out. And then I worked there for 3 years, which is like a good chunk of time, especially in the web development world. And when I left there, I was just shocked and appalled to find out at future jobs that this, way I had learned to build websites was not the default. And that everybody else was where I was when I started that job. And it was just, you know, what are you talking about? What do you mean? I don't know what this is. We have to do more work. I don't understand. And I just became the default advocate at every job I had after that. I kind of educating my peers, educating my supervisors, and just really kind of pushing for us to do a better job, basically, and make sure more people could use what we were building.
It kind of feels like when you're in a situation like that, where like the things that you were doing are just like so ingrained in your brain that when you leave that environment and go into the world again, and you're seeing people that are where you were when you started, it's almost like, did time stop? Like,
yeah.
Like what happened? Like I'm here. You should also be here, right? Like, didn't you get the same? Like, no, of course not.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I had a job for a while at Sony working on the PlayStation project. And it was right around the time that the legal team at Sony started telling the development teams that we had to start making things accessible. Mm-hmm. And so we were starting a big website redesign project. And they called the whole dev team into a meeting with the legal team. And the legal team said, hey, this new website you're building, you have to make it accessible. And I was like, okay, no problem. And then that was kind of the end of the meeting, right? They were just like, that's it? You're just going to do it? Like, yeah, sure, no problem. And it turned out that they had gotten pushback from every other team, like every other development team that they had tried to talk to had said, no way, there's no way we can do this. It's impossible. We need quadruple the budget and a big long timeline. And yeah, our team was the only one who said, sure, no problem, and then did it. So
and were those other web teams that were essentially making excuses?
Yeah, there was web teams, and then there was desktop software teams and okay, firmware yeah. teams. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think they were talking to the video game teams.
Yeah.
I think those were separate, but yeah.
What, like, so obviously, like, accessibility can come in many different forms, and validation can come in many different forms, and I think that a lot of people can really get hung up on like the tools and the process and like how to even know that they're doing things in a right or wrong way. Like, what sorts of observations from doing accessibility in so many ways and for so long have you made that sort of like, you know, like assumptions that teams that are less experienced with accessibility make when being given that task that are maybe like not as hard or not entirely accurate?
Yeah, there's, unfortunately, I think even now, most of the time when you're becoming a web developer, nobody tells you about accessibility. You know, at the time I became a web developer, there was no school. Like, you just figured that out. You saw yeah. something you liked on a website, you looked at the source code yep. and figured out how they did it. And that was all there was. But, you know, now people get degrees in it. And even then, they're not learning about accessibility. And a lot of people are doing boot camps and not learning about it. So it's just this big unknown. And I think it's pretty unfair then to push those people out into careers and expect them to somehow know how to do that. And I think it makes a lot of resentment, I think, among developers who are just, you know, stuck trying to figure out something that nobody ever mentioned to them. And I think mm-hmm. that's fair. And because it's this big unknown, I think there's a tendency to say, like, no, it's just really hard and it's really complicated. But they don't have the knowledge that they need. There are some things that can be pretty challenging to do, but also most of it is pretty straightforward and takes about the same amount of time to do in an accessible way as it would otherwise. And it's just a matter of trying to get that knowledge out there in a way that doesn't shame people or make them feel bad. And also that isn't misleading, which I think is another big area where the accessibility community is struggling with now. There's a lot of people who get the false assumption that an automated scanning tool is all they need to do, and that if they can get, you know, that perfect 100 in Lighthouse or one, you know, some other automated scanning tool, that that's it, that that's all they need to do. And that's not the case. And then there is, of course, the issue with the overlay companies who are selling, oh, you just add this one line of JavaScript to your site and it's magically accessible and you've taken care of this problem and you don't need to worry about it anymore. So there's a big misinformation campaign also that kind of struggling against too. So there's a lot of challenges there. And I have all the sympathy in the world for, you know, being expected to do something in your career to just somehow magically know something that no one ever mentioned to you during your training. And then it is kind of hard to even figure out, like, well, how do I learn it? Where do I go to figure this out? Because that's not super clear either, because it's not a part of any of the curricula. So it is, there's a lot of problems to solve, definitely, in the accessibility world.
Yeah, I mean, I was even just thinking, like, you know, for me, on the when I first started doing stuff, doing work that was required to be accessible, just knowing even the things to look for or think about was like, it was just a whole lot of information that I didn't already have in my brain. And it was very, very helpful then to be working with on that project and on subsequent projects, someone who was someone who was an expert in accessibility, and be like, no, you, because it's not just like you need to do X. It's like knowing the difference between, it's better if you do X, you can do Y, it's required that you do Z, right? Like,
yeah,
there's a range, and it's like, it's not a one-size-fits-all sort of thing necessarily. There's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of context, and it's like, you know, well, maybe your image needs alt text, but maybe if your image is purely decorative and doesn't need, then the alt text is actually a problem because it's actually giving a screen reader more noise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, information that they don't need. Yeah, I audited a website one time where the developers, bless their little hearts, had put in paragraphs long explanations of these little curly cues that were purely decorative in the design, and just had two or three paragraphs describing every turn of the little curly cue. Like, that's not doing anyone any favors. But they were just like, I heard we need alt text.
Yeah, and now with like the rise of AI and the AI's ability to like maybe even interpret those curly cues, you could like plug that decorative image into ChatGPT and say, write alt text for this, and then it's going to make, you know, that long paragraph or an even longer paragraph. Like, what impact are you noticing that AI is having now, or possibly is potentially going to have, on the world of accessibility?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two big areas, I think, where AI can have a big impact. And one is on the side of building and testing websites. So tools that could, you know, act as a person, you know, an agent to go in and run a test and figure out, you know, is the focus visible when all of the elements on this page receive focus, which is a hard thing to do with just an automated scanner, but you could do it with an agent type tool. And then, of course, you know, vibe coding and helping figure out accessible code and things like that. And then on the other side is AI to help from the assistive technology side. So enabling an assistive technology tool to not be like quite so dependent on how the developer chose to mark up a page, because it would have the ability to go in and kind of parse out the content and figure out what the intention was, regardless of what the HTML markup was behind it. So hopefully those two sides will meet somewhere in the middle and we'll end up with an improved experience for everybody else. But the case of using AI to create alt text for images is an interesting one, because I think it's something that a lot of the like magic fix tools will do is go in and create that. And I've seen plenty of tools online that are just like, here, upload your image and I'll give you alt text for it. And the problem with that is the nuance that's kind of lost there, because alt text shouldn't just be a description of the image that's on the page. It should also describe the purpose of why that image is on the page and what the context that that image is presented in. And so the exact same image could have really different alt text if it was used in different contexts, right? So like if I'm writing a blog post about ethnic cuisine and I have a picture of a dish, I might have one alt text about that dish. But if it's a recipe, then I might want a different alt text on that altogether. Or, you know, a picture of a cat and it's an article about breeds of cats. Well, then I would want to make sure I'm saying information about the breed. But if it was a blog post about cat behavior, then I would probably focus the alt text on the body language of the cat, for example. So it's not as simple, like the fix isn't as simple as, well, let's just let AI describe this image, because it doesn't know the context and like the purpose that that image is serving and what the good alt text would actually be to help somebody who couldn't see the image.
Yeah. What are some things that like you wish more people would sort of know or appreciate that maybe they don't see about accessibility? Like, I know that accessibility is important and is a thing that is talked about a lot because of like compliance laws and stuff. Although, you know, in 2026, nobody cares about that. But anyway, when they did and when they do, it's still important. but I think it's important, even if the government's websites no longer require it. But that's a whole other thing. But like a lot of times it comes up in terms of compliance. But like, and so when it comes up in terms of compliance, it's like I need to do this thing because somebody is running a scanner, somebody's requiring me to do a check, somebody doesn't want to get sued. But there's more to accessibility than just ticking a box, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's one point of view that we hear a lot is, oh, it's legal, you don't want to get sued, you don't want to get in trouble with the government, you know, depending on which part of the world you're in and which laws you're under, different things might happen. And also a lot of talk about, oh, it helps conversions, it helps SEO, it helps all of these other things. But I think what gets lost a lot of the time is that we're doing this for people, because we want to respect their basic civil rights and human rights to have equal access to information and services. And I think as more and more of our lives move online and the web becomes how we access government services and how we buy food and basic necessities for ourselves and pay our rent and apply for work and sometimes do our work, right, is all through online, it becomes more and more important that that be equally accessible to everyone and that people be allowed to have their privacy and their dignity as a person and not have to give a friend their, you know, their bank login because they can't use the bank website to do a transfer of money or whatever. I think that's the thing that gets left out and lost a lot of the time, is that it's the people, the users, are who we're doing this for, and that's the reason that the whole field exists.
One of the most impactful for me comments that I heard probably at a WordCamp presentation at some point was just the idea that accessibility, disability or ability is not a static thing, that like you are not abled or disabled. There is a spectrum, like everything else, because everything in the human experience is a spectrum, right? Like there's a spectrum of ability, and at different times of your life, at different times of the day, even, you have greater or lesser ability, right? I might be standing outside looking at my phone in the sun, and my vision ability is impaired because the sun is shining on my screen. That's an accessibility as a practice is just as much about that as it is the non-sighted person who's also trying to access that website.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people also forget that like the disability community is the only minority community that any of us could join at any time, no matter who we are. And it can happen suddenly or slowly. And the older you get, the more likely it is. And then I think also we have a kind of a weird line that we draw on that spectrum where we say, if you're on this side of the line, you're not disabled, but on the other side you are. And it's just arbitrary,
yeah.
like where that line happens to get drawn. And I don't think, you know, there's a lot of people in the world, for example, who wear glasses or contact lenses, but most of them wouldn't say I'm disabled. I have a vision disability, but that is what's going on. That is what's happening. And you're using assistive technology of glasses or contact lenses to help you out in your life. But, you know, we have this weird line that we draw where we say, oh no, that doesn't count.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah, there's so much just, and then I guess like, you know, it goes along with like bias and like the way that the system, capital S system, right? Like,
yeah,
just is built around like people who are abled and like in some sort of level of privilege, and like everything just sort of like everything moves in the direction of like what is considered like the status quo. But like there's so many different variations, and even that person that is in that moment, like in whatever, like in the world around which everything was built, right? Even that person can at some point be on the other side of that arbitrary line.
Yeah. And I think a lot to do with where we decide to draw that line has to do with the world that we build around us and what we make easy and what we make hard. And if we stopped building buildings that required tons of stairs to go and access them, would we still think of a wheelchair user as a disabled person if everybody could just easily access the building with no extra accommodation needed because we just made it easy for everyone to get in there? So there's something around that too. And there's all these different, you know, medical model and social model of disability and all these different ways of thinking about it. But to think about that, you know, someone could be considered to be disabled just because of a societal definition and nothing to do with their own body or mind. And I think that's a really interesting thing to explore and learn more about.
So tell me about Aardvark. What is it and why did you make it?
So it is an accessibility testing tool. It is a platform. You can use it with anything. It doesn't have to be a WordPress site. And it'll scan all of your pages and also help you through doing manual testing as well. And the reason that I built it was because I really needed a tool to make my life easier when I was helping people make their websites more accessible. So typically you would use some kind of a browser add-on to do the automated scans, and then that may or may not have an easy export tool to get all those issues out. And then you would do manual testing, and most people are just logging that in a spreadsheet. And then that's their deliverable at the end of an accessibility test is a giant spreadsheet of issues. And it just seems so tedious and so time consuming that I would find an issue on a page in 30 seconds and then spend 5 minutes documenting this issue and grabbing a screenshot and trying to describe where it was on the page so that when a developer came back later, they would understand exactly what I was talking about. So that is the problem that we are solving with Aardvark. So we give a visual view. You just click on an element and a box pops up to say, what's the issue that you're recording with this? It automatically fills in a bunch of stuff for you, automatically grabs the HTML, automatically grabs a screenshot. You don't have to mess around with any of it. And then that all gets combined with the automated scans all together in one platform. So you're not trying to copy paste things into spreadsheets. Everything's all together for you, all ready to go. And then we have also built in guidance for fixing accessibility issues. So a developer can come in, not necessarily be an expert at accessibility. And we're going to have text on the screen on every issue that tells you, here's what the issue is, why it's an issue, who it affects, and here's the different ways that you could go about fixing it. So it'll walk you through all of that. So trying to help make the web a better place and make accessibility a little bit easier to do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going to ask earlier because, like, I was thinking about, like, you know, as a developer, and you're saying that it's not always easy to know where to go to even find the information that would tell you how to learn the things that you need to learn. Like, that was a question I was going to ask, is like, where would I go? It sounds like you kind of built the tool to solve at least part of that problem.
Yeah. And the specific fixes for what you need on this particular website, we'll put right there in front of you and make them really easy to access. So that is what we're solving.
Yeah. Well, I'm sold. Is this sort of like a software that you download? Is it a service that you log into? What is the sort of model around it?
Yeah, it's a software as a service. So you can sign up for an account. You can add multiple websites to an account. You can invite multiple users to an account. So if you want to have a whole development team, or you want to have the client in there, accessibility testers, project managers, like, you can have everybody in there. And it has some project management features where you can assign issues to people, have a comment thread, keep the whole history of what has happened with this issue. So all of that's in there for you.
That's awesome. If I'm a developer and I'm not signing up for an account, what are some good resources that you would recommend for folks that might be watching or listening to this who want to just learn more about the practice of accessibility and expanding their brain?
Yeah, sure. If you're new to accessibility and you've tried to go and read the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines or the WCAG, WCAG, and have found it confusing or difficult to do, on the Aardvark website, we actually have a WCAG in plain English section where we've rewritten all of those in plain language with illustrations and examples. And we link out to the official documentation in the cases where you do have to dig in a little bit deeper and get into all the nitty gritty of the, you know, testing and all of that. And then for developers who want to learn accessibility, Sarah Swaydon has an excellent introduction to accessibility course that's online. You just sign up and take it at any time. I would highly recommend that one. Google actually has like a decent intro to web accessibility that's free. It's on one of the course websites, like Coursera or something like that. It's on there for free. So that's a good place to get started too. And then I do a ton of live streams and put out social media content and blog posts and everything else, introducing people to the concepts behind accessibility too.
How much does that stuff get into the sort of places where there are nuance? Like, if I know that, like, I can throw a site into a scanner and it'll give me the WCAG, you know, recommendations, but I also know, because I've worked with accessibility experts, that like I said earlier, like, there's nuance. How much is some of the documentation or some of these courses, like, do they get into that sort of stuff?
They do, and they'll help you to kind of figure out, you know, with anything in web development, it's not just accessibility, right? The answer to any question is always, it depends.
Right.
There's no hard and fast answer. And it's the same thing in accessibility as well. So there's always nuance and there's layers of things that you have to keep in mind. And sometimes you're facing constraints because of the platform that you've built on, or the way something was set up, you know, before you came along, and you have limited ability to change things. And so to figure out, like, what fix makes the most sense in this case is where you have to try to figure things out. And I think Sarah Swaydon's course is definitely going to handle a lot of that. And then I try to tackle a lot of that too. And, you know, I talk to developers and figure out what are the things that they're struggling with and help them kind of figure out what might be the best solution for this here. In the case that we can't implement the perfect ideal solution, like, what would be the best compromise that's going to remove as many barriers as we can and ensure as many people as possible can use whatever it is that we're working on?
Within the WordPress ecosystem specifically, the world of accessibility or an implementation of accessibility for a site is often handled by the theme which produces most of the code that is rendered on the front end of the site. How much would you say, like, how good is that for, I mean, obviously, again, it depends, right? But like if you just had a site, like I have a site that is using 2025, right? Or any other default theme, like, am I mostly okay? Am I mostly not okay? Like, where on the spectrum, just taken at a baseline, how much is WordPress kind of, or a really well-developed WordPress theme doing for me versus how much stuff do I need to think about sort of after the fact?
Yeah, all of the default themes, the 20-something themes, they're all accessibility ready. So they all have that tag in the WordPress.org repo. And they are accessibility ready and not accessible because it then depends on what you do with it. So they have done, the theme developer has done everything they can on their side to help make sure that your website is accessible. But then a lot of it comes down now to what plugins are you going to add? How are you managing content when you're adding it into the site? And then how are you configuring and adjusting all of the settings in there too? Because even if you have an accessibility ready theme and you choose a plugin that's reasonably accessible and you're being careful with your content, you could still make mistakes in how you set something up and configuration options that you choose. So there's a lot of different pieces on a WordPress site that have to work together to end up with an accessible result, because we have so many moving parts. And unfortunately, plugins don't have the equivalent of the accessibility ready tag in the repo. So it's up to you kind of as a consumer to test those out and figure out which ones are accessible and which ones aren't. And it might depend on how you set them up. So it'd be even really hard to publish like a scorecard or something of saying like, oh, here's all the plugins we found that are accessible.
Sure.
Somebody might come along and use it, but set pale yellow text on a white background and now it's not. So it is a really tricky thing and there's a lot of moving parts, and I think made even more complicated by the number of people who are setting up their own WordPress site and they're not developers and they don't have any kind of knowledge at all about accessibility. And there is a separate accessibility guideline, ATAG, that I actually just posted about yesterday on LinkedIn. That's the authoring tool accessibility guidelines, which would apply to WordPress as an authoring tool, where your tool is required under that guideline to walk people through creating accessible content and to help make sure that they are aware that, like, when they upload an image, that you're prompting them that this needs alternative text. If they do that pale yellow text on a white background, that you're showing them a warning to say, you might need to choose a darker color for your text, and that you're actually helping them out. And I think WordPress doesn't do a great job of that in a lot of cases, and especially once you start getting into all the different plugins, they don't always do a great job at that and actually guiding the user toward the most accessible choices.
Good to know that I can still screw up my site.
Yeah, I know. That wasn't very encouraging.
Well, I wanted to end it on a high note, so... well, no, thank you very much for like going over it. Accessibility is a huge, broad topic, and obviously you have made kind of a career of talking about it and using it, and you have your videos and stuff that you do to guide people through it, and because it's an ever changing and ever evolving practice, and it is incredibly, incredibly important for, like you said, the people to use the internet. So I am very grateful that people like you exist that know a lot more about it than I do and can teach
me.
And for everyone who might be watching or listening, where can they find you on the internet and learn more about this stuff?
Yeah, so I have a handy shortcut for the Aardvark website, because aardvarkaccessibility.com is really long. So you can just go to a20y.com and get to accessibility. And then for my personal site, it's just nataliemack.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Natalie McLeese, for being on my show. Thank everyone for watching or listening to this in the future. And everyone, we'll see you all on the internet.